Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game with me, Kevin Day, and Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire. Think of us as the 10-metre synchronised divers of the podcasting world. I'm not proud of saying this, Kieran, but Ali's actually hidden a TV remote because she got fed up with me constantly rewinding the diving, saying, hang on a second, I only counted three twists. It was only half a tuck then. I still don't know what a tuck is, but that doesn't stop me being a fully professional Olympic diving pub judge now. Olympics are great, Kieran. They've unexpectedly turned into a brilliant celebration of sport, haven't they?
Yeah, yes. I mean, I found myself on Tuesday morning screaming at the television in respect of the taekwondo. When our medalist lost in the last second and they went back to the studio, it was like the country was in mourning. And it's that fascinating love of these people who make incredible sacrifices and make you so proud of your country because they are part of it, and that sense of kinship. Yeah, it's been fantastic, and it's relit my fires.
Yeah, it's also that brilliant thing where you want your country's athletes, gymnasts, cyclists to win, but also you really don't mind when they don't, because everybody else has got a brilliant story as well.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
Yeah, and it's actually the lack of crowd. It hasn't affected it as much as I thought, and I've been getting really emotional. Tom Daly's. I met Tom Daly a couple of times when he was a youngster with his dad, who was the nicest bloke you could meet. So I was, all these backstories are really affecting me. Now, Kieran, unfortunately, Tracy Crouch couldn't join us this week because it turns out MPs are quite busy people.
Yes.
But she definitely will be on in 2 weeks' time. So what we plan to do between now and then is have a look at some of her recommendations following that fan-led review, and then go into details when we chat. And that will also give people, listeners, a chance to send in some questions, basically, if we have a look at some of the things that she plans to recommend. But in the meantime, Kieran, we have some news. And that our light-hearted story about massive US investment in Brazilian football has turned into, it's all kicking off in Brazil, Kieran.
It is. One of our Brazilian listeners, Yao, got in contact with me and to say, well, if we thought that, yeah, we were taking it fairly flippantly by saying that Brazilian midweek fixtures could only take place after 9 o'clock because it disrupted the soap operas who wanted and the TV companies who wanted their soap to go out earlier. Well, it turns out that Brazilian football had its own version of a soap opera when the heads, the presidents of the individual clubs met up on Zoom. And it turns out that they don't like each other. now, whereas we know that Mel Morris and Steve Gibson of Derby County in Middlesbrough, you wouldn't put those two in a pantomime horse together. You know, those two, you know, like to snipe, and that's about as far as it goes. You know, a few bitchy comments in the press.
Kieran, can I just stop you there, Kieran? I can't let that moment pass because I was expecting small room, dark alley, but suddenly pantomime horse is your analogy for enclosed space. there are many, many people I wouldn't recommend putting in a pantomime horse together, Kim, but if Mel Morris and Steve Gibson would like to do that for charity, I'm sure we could raise quite a lot of money.
I think we would. Yeah, I think that'd be fantastic.
There'd be a massive argument as to who's going to be the arse end, though, wouldn't there? Sorry to interrupt you, Kieran. Carry on, because this Brazilian story is actually more complex than we believed, isn't it?
Well, yes. It turns out that Guillaume Bellentini, the president of EC Bahia, said that he wasn't happy about having the meeting on Zoom because he wanted to have a more nuanced discussion. But Mario Petraglia, the president of Club Atletico, said that that wouldn't be very successful because if he got anywhere near Bellentini, he'd smack him in the face and he'd invite him outside into the car park. We've got memories of Sunday football whereby, you know, if somebody went through you, you'd say, well, we don't want to get fined by the referee or a red card, so I'll sort you out afterwards. So it was. It sounded like it absolutely kicked off in true Brazilian style. Because Brazilian domestic football doesn't really have any stars left because they all go straight away to Europe, we're now having to rely on the club president to provide entertainment for the fans over there by threatening to do 15 rounds with each other.
Is this because the club presidents can't agree on what to do about this proposed takeover of Brazilian football by this US investment company?
Yes. It ultimately, as is always the case with these things, and we've seen it with the Premier League, because the big six clubs used to go off into their own little huddle and sort of smirk at the owners of the other clubs, say, we've got all the power. This is all to do with who gets what in terms of the distribution of monies. Money, as we've discovered over the course of this show, is the root of all evil, but can be very entertaining at the same time.
Mm. Two things, Kieran. I played Sunday football on and off for 11 years. Not once did I offer anybody into a car park.
You don't drive.
Well, that doesn't stop me using car parks, Kieran, does it? That wasn't the reason I didn't end up offering somebody out into a car park. I didn't walk to these games. Somebody had a car. It's more that I was your rough upbringing has led to you living on a vineyard in Sussex. And, the man who's offered people out in car parks is living high on the hog on a vineyard. And the peaceful man is living in Norbury. That's all I'm saying. And secondly, Kieran, we've talked about Brazil for two programs running, and not once did you mention Brazilians. I'm actually quite emotional. That's a great sign that you are either you're growing up, or the Baroness told you that she would be very cross if you launched into a stream.
This is part of my silent protest against Manscaped since they ditched us. that I'm not going to give them. I'm not going to give the oxygen of publicity, Kevin. That's why.
After all this time, Kieran, I still find levels in you that I didn't know existed. Premier League fans, as was highly publicised, Premier League fans who have not been fully vaccinated could be barred from attending matches from October. Now, if this is extended to League One and League Two clubs, Kieran, that could severely hit matchday income, couldn't it?
It could. This is something which is being talked about at present. So there's no definitive approach being taken, but the government is uncomfortable about the level of take-up in terms of vaccination, especially amongst younger people. So if the Premier League effectively will need some form of licensing or some form of approval for events for which have more than 20,000 people attending. So that could be through the route of a vaccination passport. If there's events taking place with less than 20,000 people, there again could be some form of encouragement. My concern there, that's Finlay walking his way through the dog, and he's got a wonky job. My concern here is,
should we explain that to first time listeners, or we can let them?
I understand the wish to incentivize more people to take up the vaccination. Yeah, I'm double jabbed, you're double jabbed. I think everybody I know is doing so. But how would this be policed? Given that I used my NHS app last night to get my vaccination passport, and then it says this is valid for 28 days. It's a QR code. This can be read at grounds. So what you would now have to do is that more and more clubs are providing their season tickets via an app. And if you're going to get your vaccination passport via an app as well, what happens if your phone fails? The Wi-Fi at football clubs, I think, can best be described as patchy, veering to non-existent. If you have to try to download something, you can't get a signal. And people get a bit testy, don't they, when they're delayed getting into a football ground. So I think this has to be, if it's going to be introduced, then We've got to be cautious about how it's done. You can understand the incentives from the government's point of view. The Premier League clubs are desperate to have as many people attending as possible. So I think they are more than happy to be compliant. I crunched the numbers the other day. Premier League clubs have lost over £1,200 million in 2019-20. So heaven knows what last season is going to be like. But it's not a cure-all because the technology isn't necessarily as good as people think it is. And what happens if you're trying to stick your phone underneath some reader, the reader's not picking it up, and there's somebody behind you getting a bit arsy, so you say something to him, he says something to you, and we're back to car parks again, aren't we? So, you know, I'm just conscious. You know, you've only got to look to see what happened at Wembley, where if you do not have good systems in place, you end up with things getting very messy.
Well, also, football, as we know, is a hotbed of conspiracy theories, and already several people have said that they attended friendlies in the past few days at various levels. And, of course, the club websites concerned are all encouraging people to get to the ground much earlier because of queuing time, COVID protocols, et cetera, et cetera. So why not make your way to the bar or the executive lounge or the fan park? So why not, in other words, why not have an extra 2 hours at the club drinking our beer rather than leaving things late in the pub drinking their beer? So that's a cynical interpretation. But again, you kind of wouldn't put it past some of the top clubs in the Premier League to try and exploit that by getting people in earlier. It's also it's a strange one to use football as a blackmail tool. I mean, it's not even from a safety point of view. It's not even we want people to be certain that they're safe going into football games. It's just like a sledgehammer way to incentivize young people to do it. And it's you kind of worry that there's going to be three generations of a family attending a match as they have done for years. And the old one's going to be fine, and the young one's going to be fine because they don't have to be vaccinated. But but dad or mum in the middle, who may not yet have a double jab for various reasons, can't go to the game. So it's a strange one. But I mean, it would be bad news for League One and League Two, though, wouldn't it? If because it's going to put off casual fans anyway. Surely, even the very idea that you think, oh God, I've got to show my COVID passport just because I fancy going to see Bradford versus whoever it is today.
Yes. Yeah. And as you said at the start of this particular story, the League One and League Two clubs are far more reliant upon match day income. It can be 45-50% of total money coming in. We did extremely well to get through 2020-21 without losing a club, with the exception of Macclesfield.
Yeah.
And Macclesfield was nothing to do with COVID. That doesn't guarantee that we will have an equally successful 2021-22, because I think the goodwill of fans has also sort of starting to run out in terms of just how far they're willing to give up some of their money, sacrifice last season's season ticket, and so on. So I think they will be expecting some form of return. And whilst it's a view that I don't share, some people do have an objection to the vaccine from a government interference point of view in their lives. And personally, I just want to say I want to save my life and I want to save others. That's the nature of living in a democracy, that some people they won't be wearing the club kit because they'll be wearing tinfoil, of course, when they attend the matches or try to attend the matches, feel that it's an infringement of their civil liberties.
Yeah, well, if there are any fans who have refused to be vaccinated because the government are putting a mini computer into their bloodstream, then they need a separate turnstile that leads somewhere other than the ground, basically. The Premier League and EFL clubs, on a similar note, are going to put vaccine clauses in players' contracts, it seems.
This is a discussion at present. The take-up at some clubs amongst players, especially the younger players and apprentices, has been very low. I think the clubs would rather players get double-jabbed, because we have seen COVID protocols being breached. We've seen matches being called off. I think Arsenal and Everton were due to play in a tournament in Florida.
Yeah.
And Arsenal pulled out at the last minute. I think Milan pulled out at the last minute. And I believe Everton, they were either on the aircraft or about to board the aircraft when all this took place. So it got a bit embarrassing and things didn't go ahead. So again, this comes back to where are we in October? And the government is certainly keen on players and backroom staff to be double jabbed because that's going to reduce the spread amongst players. How's this going to be enforced? I think it's going to be very difficult. In terms of the position of the PFA, they are between a rock and a hard place. You know, they've got to represent their members. And if one of their members says, well, I don't feel comfortable about it, you know, given the nature of my age group, it's a relatively mild complaint.
Yeah.
There has been one player, I think, who had a reaction. People are using that as an example. Now, whether that was due to COVID, genuinely, we're not certain. At the same time, the PFA wants to ensure that matches take place because it's in the interest of their members. So there has been talk about new contracts. I think they'll find it very difficult to introduce these into existing clauses. You know, we saw the PFA with our friend Nick DiMarco very successfully defend the attempt to impose a wage cap on players last season. But going forwards, it could be something that would be part of a club's contract, which they would offer to players.
Yes, I find it fascinating that there are players who won't be vaccinated. As you think the clubs would, well, they can't force them, but you know, clubs can certainly force players not to drink copious amounts of alcohol during the week or endanger their lives by parachuting. So it's interesting that there are players who feel strongly enough about it to jeopardise their career at a club not to do it. But let's just look forward to the day when we have a pod that we don't have to mention COVID again.
Yeah.
And here's a story I didn't think we'd be mentioning again, but it's come back. Three of Britain's most senior judges have ruled that Manchester City's secret legal battle with the Premier League could be made public. Can you remind us of the background to this story, Kieran?
Yes. People are aware that Manchester City were charged by UEFA in respect of some of their sponsorship income. And the allegations, and this was part of sort of the Football Leaks project, the allegation was that Manchester City were effectively disguising sponsorship income and that the sponsors were being reimbursed by the club owner. So let's say that City had a £60 million a year deal with Etihad Airways. And the allegation is that City, that the Etihad Airways were getting £50 million of this back through the club owner. But this allowed City to comply with financial fair play. Now, as far as UEFA were concerned, as we were aware with what happened last year, City were initially given a 2-year ban, but on appeal, they successfully overturned that. And instead, they were just given a 10 million euro fine for not complying particularly well with UEFA's request for information. It turns out that in parallel to this, the Premier League have been investigating Manchester City and its compliance with financial fair play. And this started in December 2018. And at times, the Premier League have requested documents from City. City have refused. The Premier League changed its constitution, so they had to submit those documents. And this is all to do with the belief amongst some, and there is, at present, there is no proof either way, that Manchester City's commercial incomes have been overstated. And this has also been taking place in various courts. Now, Manchester City do not want this publicised as we go through step by step, but it also turns out that the Premier League don't particularly want this publicised as well. You know, if you take a look at the Premier League website, there's nothing coming up in terms of the proceedings and the progress. But a judge rightly said, given that this started in December 2018, well, since that, Manchester City have won the Premier League twice. They've appeared in the Champions League final. They've won other trophies as well. And effectively saying, stop dragging this out. She also accused the Premier League of wanting to have its cake and eat it, in the sense that it's told other clubs that these proceedings are taking place, but it's not telling the general public. So it's being selective. It's saying, you know, we will prosecute you to try to put clubs under pressure. And then, of course, we've got the Newcastle United situation, because the owner of Newcastle United, Mike Ashley, he wants his dispute, of which there are two taking place at present with the Premier League, to be taking place in the public domain. And yet the Premier League seem to be very keen on things to be private when it suits them, and to leak information when it suits them as well.
So if this ruling goes against Man City, what are the possible financial ramifications then?
Well, it could be very weird. It could be that if the Premier League conclude, and they are going through an arbitration process, arbitration is cheaper and quicker than a court case. Yeah, we've established that. If it turns out they could be subject to fines, if they exceed the financial fair play limit, they could be subject to a points deduction. But the crazy thing is that under the Premier League rules, you're allowed to lose £105 million over the three-year assessment period, compared to €30 million. So we could end up in a ludicrous situation where the Premier League arbitration panel concludes that Manchester City have been in breach of the rules. They then recalculate the numbers, and it works out that City's losses are £90 million over 3 years. Therefore, they're under the statute in terms for which other punishment applies, and they just get a finger wagging. So this will run and run. Possessors of silver tongues are not going short. Yeah, if you think about it, this has taken 2.5 years. If you take a look at the list of people that Manchester City employ as their legal advisors, we are talking the golden circle in terms of legal representation. So it's going to be very costly, regardless of what happens. It's just been dragging on far too long, and nobody's exactly sure what ultimately is the objective of the Premier League in all of this, or are they just reacting to pressure from other clubs, as is the viewpoint taken by Mike Ashley and also by many Newcastle fans, is that the Big Six don't want further competition. They don't want Newcastle to make it a Big Seven, and if they can if they can also knock Manchester City out of contention for certain things as well, they'd only be too delighted to do so, because it increases the chances of other clubs being given a place for the Champions League.
To a team that's just left the Premier League, and Fulham's parent company, Cougar Hold Co., has written off £151 million of loans by converting them into shares. And I noticed you tweeted late last night or this morning about the amount of money that Fulham's parent company have put into the club recently.
Yes. I mean, for people not familiar with the Fulham story, Shahid Khan, who's owner of the Jacksonville Jaguars? He's very successful in the US. Mm-hmm. He acquired Fulham in July 2013. And since then, he has put in £410 million. Yeah, that is... Wow. And he's now said most of that is in the form of loans. And for reasons which I can't quite work out, he's now said, right, well, some of that I'm going to effectively write off and convert those into shares. So £150 million, that will buy a round or two in the Pawson's Arms, wouldn't it, Kevin? What concerns me is that I've now got into the habit of talking about millions and tens of millions of hundreds of millions of pounds, and it doesn't matter anymore. They just become meaningless numbers.
Yeah.
And we all just shrug them off. And I think it is uh, it is indicative of football as an industry has hugely expanded, and we've become fatigued to the sums involved because, you know, Bury did not go bust on the back of owing £410 million. You know, Macclesfield didn't go bust. We were talking small sums of money, relatively. Yeah, we took, you know, hundreds of thousands. You know, and again, I'm now talking about hundreds of thousands of pounds as being a small sum of money. I think football is in danger of losing all sense of scale when it comes to the finances.
Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
It would buy a lot of drinks in the Pawson's Arms, Kieran, and disappointingly, you can now buy those drinks with a card, which you couldn't do for 20 years. It's always one of the joys of drinking in the Pawson's Arms when some flash git would order a big round and then go to pay with it by card, and little John behind the bar would say, "It's cash only, mate." I know, and the nearest cash point is a 17-minute walk away, which is... We used to time it. We used to time how long it took a stranger to leave the bar, come back with cash.
Now, my mate Scratch Card, he would use that in his favour because he is a dodger when it comes to buying his round. And he would go, I was going to buy. Yeah, so he'd make he's the type of guy who would make a big fight. Yeah, I will get around this week, guys, and then go to, oh, I've only got my card. Somebody else. So yeah, have you got dodgers amongst your mates, or do they all just know the rules?
Oh no, my mates all just know. They're gentlemen when it comes to buying around, Kieran. So Roy's moved to Wales. He's been hounded out or anything for not buying around. It's those classic football thing. Roy, I don't think I ever remember Roy missing a buying around in my life, but once you get a reputation. Yeah, back in 1981, he obviously wasn't first to the bar once, and that's it. That's his reputation. Right, Roy's buying a drink. Get a photograph. and sport. Speaking of the Pawson's Arms, Kieran, it's just down the road from possibly the world's second oldest football club, Crystal Palace, whose latest figures are out, which for me is not as exciting as their rather natty third kit. Which is a celebration of being possibly the world's second oldest football club. But yes, we were the last bar Newcastle to release our figures, were we not, for the latest?
Yes, yeah. And part of the reason for that was that Palace did extend their year end to the 31st of July, so that they hadn't actually broken any rules. But it was a tough year for Palace, as it was for all clubs.
Yeah.
So Palace lost £60 million in 2019-20. And remember, you've only got the impact of COVID on five home matches.
Yeah.
But, you know, looking at the state of Palace, I think Palace were in the bottom six when it comes to matchday income. So you can see why Steve Parish is keen to expand the ground. And also to increase the proportion of seats which are sold to the hospitality division, because whether we like them or not, and I know we sneer at them, they do generate large amounts of money. I think the thing which possibly worried me the most was that for every £100 of revenue that was being generated by Palace, £93 of that was going out in wages. Now, again, I suspect the club's done things to address that this summer, because I believe that, is it 11 players were out of contract?
Yes, we've massively reduced our wage bill, hugely reduced, which will enable us, or has helped us, to bring in a couple of younger players. But our wage bill was ludicrous, and it has been people like Sacco and Connor Wickham going, who were on eye-watering amounts of money has really helped. Gary Cahill as well was on a very big wage. So, yes, our wage bill has been reduced significantly.
Yeah, because looking at these numbers, the average wage paid at Palace, based on my calculations, was just shy of 57 grand a week. And, you know, that's more than Villa, Bournemouth, certainly more than us at Brighton, Burnley. Nor, you know, they were Palace were probably punching above their weight in terms of wages. And, you know, it's your club, and you will probably know some of those players, in your opinion, weren't necessarily delivering the level of entertainment that those wages were connected to.
Yes, and I hope you weren't implying, Kieran, that our unexpected reveal that we could be the world's second oldest football club is not related to trying to get new people into the grounds, into those new hospitality suites, Kieran.
No, not at all. No, but, absolutely not.
Well, I think you're wrong, because I think it probably is. So, Kieran, you were part of former sports minister Tracy Crouch's fan-led review into the state of football, a sport which she says is facing an existential crisis. Before we have a look at some of the things in her interim report, what was your role in the fan-led review? What did they want to talk to you about specifically? Obviously finance, but what specific areas of football finance?
I was one of many groups who did present. There were, you know, people from fan groups, people from the finance profession, even some German fans, the 50 plus one rule. Just to sort of compare British fan culture to English fan culture. I mean, the questions that I was asked, and it was a pretty broad panel. Yeah, there were people from Football Support Association, there were people from the football industry itself, was mainly to do with the unequal distribution of money within the game. I've always been concerned about the cliff edges.
Yeah,
between divisions, yeah, between the Premier League and the Championship, but also between the Championship and League One and League Two and the National League, but also within divisions. Is it in the long term interests of football for there to be such huge gaps between the clubs at the top and the bottom? Manchester United, Liverpool, Chelsea, huge global brands. They deserve, they deserve a lot of the money that's coming their way. But it has created this gap. You know, if you take a look at the Premier League table in its very first season and look to see where Arsenal, Spurs, Chelsea, and Manchester City finished, they were not towards the top.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were not competing for trophies. So again, it's something that this concept of the Big Four or the Big Six has come into day-to-day talk. Well, why should it be that way? So I did an analysis of where the money has come from. Also put some suggestions as to how football could be distributed in a different way. You know, perhaps we could move back to the system of some form of sharing to a greater extent of you know, gate receipts. The EFL has said that they want 25% of the Premier League TV money. Well, you know, could gate receipts be split 75-25, for example? Yeah, would that help? Could we have a levy on transfers? And one thing which we did sort of raise eyebrows, because it's you could accuse me of being populist here. The biggest success in Premier League history has not been football; it's been the gambling industry. Why can't we have a relationship between the gambling industry and football, similar to the gambling industry and the horse racing industry? So perhaps a small levy, a levy of 0.5% on football bets, just from the big four companies, would raise a huge amount of money. So it wouldn't put people off betting. It would still allow the betting companies themselves to make profits. But at present, I'm never in favour of prohibition of anything. I'm a pretty liberal guy in most of my outlook on life. But getting it right on the dial, I think, is something. So that was sort of the type of thing I was looking at. And, you know, let's be honest, I am a dweeb when it comes to numbers. So a lot of the questions were, you know, how much money is being spent on X, Y, and Z in terms of transfers, in terms of wages, in terms of other overheads, in terms of tax. I was just there to sort of be a repository of unusual statistics.
Mm. That should be the tattoo you get, Kieran, just a repository of unusual statistics. Also, I've just had an idea. What you should start doing is betting on fights in car parks.
Yes.
Clearly, you're an experienced operative here. Let's have a look at a couple of things, because I'd be interested to get the response of our listeners to this, and hopefully in the form of questions for Tracy. And, of course, gambling is something she feels strongly about, because that's the reason she resigned as a minister in the first place, was in the government's reluctance to limit the amount of money you could lose on fixed odds gambling machines in betting shops. The full review is out in the autumn, but some of her initial proposals are basically mirror what we've been asking for a long time. And she starts with an acknowledgement, and I quote here, that football clubs are not ordinary businesses. They play a critical social and civic role. Somebody at the door, or is he?
Yeah. There's a van outside.
Oh, God.
Stop it. Not you, Kevin.
No, Finley. As the Baroness has trained Finley to bark when working class people appear, isn't she? Yes. So Tracy was saying that clubs play an important role in their local communities. They need to be protected. And this is what fascinated me. They need to be protected sometimes from their owners. Now, this is a sentiment we 100% endorse, but may not be shared by more traditional business-minded members of the government, I'm guessing. But the first thing that struck me is that she argues very strongly for a new independent regulator to cover finance, corporate governance, and ownership.
If I'd written the report, I would love to have written love to have written what Tracy had written. I think she's absolutely nailed the key issues. So having a person, an organisation which is responsible for these issues, if you get finance, governance and ownership right, then you get an awful lot of football's problems dealt with.
Mm.
Because to stop people trying to flip clubs, Leeds United spent 16 years outside of the Premier League. Why was that? It's because they went through a succession of owners who just saw it as an opportunity to make a quick buck. And it's not Holmes under the hammer. We are dealing with, Tracy Crouch said that football clubs are community assets. They are part of heritage. It was the same with Portsmouth. You know, how did we allow a situation for people to be able to treat football clubs as just another entity? So again, I'm not blowing my own trumpet yet. One of the things I brought up was a good faith bond. When you buy a football club, you have to put down a deposit, which is kept presumably by IREF. I think this is the name for the regulator. And you don't get that back until, let's say, 12 months after you've sold the club. When the regulator can see whether the behaviour of the owners has been of an appropriate standard. So, it's very encouraging. And I also like the fact that she said the rest of football should be left to football. In terms of the day to day nonsense which occupies our minds so often and fills the column inches. We don't want some sort of dictatorship as to how football should behave, but those areas which can affect the long-term existence and sustainability is something which she was very keen to address.
Yeah, she also suggested potential reform at the FA. I'm slightly annoyed that there's two qualifying words here rather than demanding reform, but she suggested potential reform at the FA, the Football League and the Premier League, with at least 50% of the FA board to be independent non-executive directors. Now, why would that be important?
Well, at present, and she certainly said that you know, something which we have discussed at length in recent episodes of the podcast, in terms of governance, to remove club directors from the board of the EFL, and the same at the National League. And the rationale behind this is that if you are representing a club, you know, if you are a club director, your prime focus, your prime responsibility should be to act in the best interests of that football club. There is absolutely nothing wrong with that. You know, that's, you know, if that's what you should be doing. But if you also then go on the board of the EFL, you will be acting in your self-interest when you should be acting on a more broader sphere. So having independent directors who are coming from a non-football background, who can bring a much broader skill set and knowledge of business, and if football says, well, they don't understand football, yeah, we're perfectly good at running ourselves, Just take a look at the losses these clubs are being made, you know, when they're allowed to run themselves. So I think that was something which was a really positive step. She also, at one stage, she appeared to be sort of suggesting that the EFL and the National League should have a closer relationship bordering on a merger. And I think there's positives to be learned there because, you know, we've seen in terms of the National League board, that appears to be a bit erratic, to put it mildly.
Yeah, we'll look at, in detail at a few more proposals next week. But I want to finish this week, Kieran, with my favourite, actually, which is greater protection for club assets such as badges, locations and colours through a golden share for supporters that will provide them with veto powers. Now, I can't imagine there'd be many clubs happy to give supporters veto over these matters. How would that work? But we've seen just recently with the argument about who owns Bury's badge, how important these things are to football fans. Your kit, your nickname, your ground, your badge, they're all part of your history and your community. And it's very good that she recognises that and recognises that fans would love the opportunity to stop new club owners doing what Vincent Tam did at Cardiff, for example, and changing the colour of the kit.
Yes, well, this should work relatively smoothly if it's brought in, and I think it would have to come in either directly from legislation or via the regulator. What you could do is, if we take a look at the constitution of the Premier League, it has 21 shares, and I think we discussed this on Sunday.
We did,
of which 20, which, you know, one club per vote, which again, you know, some people don't seem to think is a good idea, which baffles me. But the Football Association has a golden share, which it can sort of use in restricted circumstances. And normally it doesn't. You know, normally it just, I said, you know, we will let you in the Premier League. You just do what the hell you want to do. And we will only use our vote if we feel it's necessary. Now, that may have been, Kevin, if we go back to Project Big Picture, that may have been why the people behind Project Big Picture were willing to give the Football Association a £100 million gift.
You're cynical this week, Kieran.
I'm just saying the two things may have been connected. But what you could do is to say that if you are to be a member of the an EFL club or a Premier League club, the regulator says you've got to change the constitution of the leagues, and you will have A shares, which are given to the ordinary owners, and you will have a B share, and the B share is given to the fans' representative groups. And the B share can only be used for these specific purposes, and it is effectively a power of veto. So it could work that way. You're absolutely right. Do the clubs want fans interfering? No, they don't. You know, we've seen, you know, following the collapse of Super League, there was a sort of, we're not as bad guys as you make us out to be, from the likes of John Henry, Stan Kroenke, and the Glazers. And then since then, things have gone very silent, i.e. fob people off with crocodile tears, and then we can get back to our usual business. So, we'll wait to see there. You know, I'm not in favour of the 50 plus one rule of Germany coming to the UK. I think we're too far down the road to have such a radical change. But this would be an opportunity for clubs to be held to account in terms of certain elements of decision making by the people that turn in week out.
So you're not in favour of the 50 plus one rule in general, or you just think it's impractical the way English football is organised?
Yeah, I don't think it would work in English football because you'd have to compensate existing owners for the control which is being taken away from them. If we were starting with a blank sheet of paper today and designing football, yes, I'd have it.
Yeah.
And that's the advantage that they got in Germany. The DFB did that many years ago, and it's proven to be reasonably successful. But at the same time, you know, we know who's going to win the Bundesliga every year. Is it necessarily an improvement in all areas of football, because it doesn't encourage people to come in, as we've seen with the likes of Abramovich and Mansour, to be disruptors and challenges to the existing clubs. Prior to Abramovich arriving in English football, the Premier League was won by Manchester United or Arsenal for a very long period of time.
Is
that necessarily good?
Yeah. Well, we'll look at more details of the fan-led review next Thursday on our next news pod. In the meantime, on Monday, of course, we have our questions pod. And if you have any questions for that, it's questions@priceoffootball.com. And Kieran, you'll be glad to know that one of your answers to a question last week has led to an actual invitation to a tear up in a car park. Which is a slightly surprising reaction. It was in context, but anybody in Melbourne may like to know that in the next week or so, when all this is over, there might be a massive punch up in a car park near you, which is a good indication of how the questions pod goes sometimes. And in the meantime, before then, I shall hand you over to Mr. Kieran Maguire for his customary farewell.
Well, again, folks, thanks very much for the feedback. We really have been knocked out by the welcome back that you've had, and the fact that you missed us when we disappeared for a fortnight. If you can press those follow buttons for Spotify and Apple Podcasts, it helps us in the charts, and it helps our credibility when we're trying to get guests on the show, and also when Guy sends out his customary begging letters to potential sponsors. And also, if anybody does want to sponsor the show for the forthcoming season, just get in contact with us at questions@priceoffootball.com, because since Manscaped disappeared, we've not really had one.
I think you'll find we have got one, Kieran.
Oh.
Remember, we did the advert for one. I'm sure they're still sponsoring us. Guy may have to cut this. Yeah, Guy might have to cut this bit out.
Right, yeah.
Well, I'm fairly certain we have got. I don't listen to the pod that often, so I don't. that's not the high note that we normally end the pod on, is it?
No.
Again, yeah, another reason why I'm wasting my time clearing that space on the shelf for the BAFTA. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
The Price of Football. Price of Football.